Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Neil Shore, MD, FACS, about the use of androgen deprivation therapy in prostate cancer management. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Shore discussed guidelines for incorporating ADT into prostate cancer clinical practice, toxicities and quality of life complications associated with this class of agents that healthcare providers should be aware of and try to mitigate, and the importance of shared decision-making between members of the multidisciplinary team as well as patients. So just to start off talking about ADT in prostate cancer, what have been some of the most recent NCCN guideline updates regarding the use of this class of agents here?
Well, I think it's really important that we do a lot of appropriate counseling on making this decision about testosterone suppression or androgen deprivation therapy. You know, obtaining a baseline testosterone is very important. Understanding the impact of testosterone's lowering, whether you're using an agonist or an antagonist, I think is really should be everyone's baseline. And most importantly, if you're going to invoke testosterone suppression, is talking to patients about the totality of all the different adverse events that can happen. The most common being hot flush or hot flash, sexual dysfunction, decreased libido, but then also breast involvement could be gynecomastia, breast enlargement, nipple breast tenderness, abdominal weight gain, visceral weight gain, loss of muscle mass, sarcopenia, and very importantly, decrease in bone mineral density. And this is all goes under the sort of heading of the cardiometabolic syndrome. It can have impacts on our triglycerides and lipids. And essentially, I think ultimately the guidelines are really pushing us more towards a multidisciplinary approach and recognizing that there's not a free lunch with lowering a man's testosterone. Yes, we've got decades of impact from Huggins and Hodges and surgical castration. Now we use the parenteral therapies and now an oral therapy with relugolix. But I think we're really realizing now NCCN, other guidelines, that we need to be better stewards of the impact of, other than the clinical impact of lowering PSA, putting cancer cells into remission. But then additionally, now most of the times that we're going to invoke ADT, it should almost be part and parcel with also committing patients to an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor.
Do you have any other things that you would want to add about the safety profile of relugolix or some of the ways that these adverse effects could be mitigated?
All the testosterone-lowering agents, the parenterals, IM, sub-Q, agonist, antagonist, relugolix is unique because it's oral. It's the only oral testosterone-lowering a medication that's approved by regulatory agencies. I was very proud to have been one of the investigators on the HERO trial. I think that one of the things we saw in that trial was a signal that there was a better or a decrease in what are called major adverse cardiovascular events, or MACEs. So essentially that there could be a better cardiovascular profile in terms of deleterious effects. We saw that actually in several degarelix trials, but we don't really have the level one evidence of a phase three prospective trial to say that an antagonist, whether it be parenteral in the form of deep sub-Q degarelix or oral relugolix, is without any doubt better from a cardiovascular standpoint. There's a lot of evidence that points in that direction, including the HERO trial and many other real-world association of claims data globally and in the U.S. Trials have been done to try and answer it, and it really hasn't been successful. But there is some new data that I think will be coming out soon, is in the next coming few weeks, and maybe getting presented at the American Heart Association, looking at a coronary plaque, calcified versus non-calcified, and in particularly relugolix versus LHRH agonist. So I think there's going to be some really interesting data on that. which will inform us vis-a-vis the cardio-oncologic negative adverse events of one versus the other. You know, I think the important thing to know is that these patients, these men, have so many cardio risk factors at the beginning. They're older. They're men. They're smokers. They may have obesity issues. They may be diabetic. They may be hypertensive. They may have family histories of cardiovascular inclinations for disease. And so, I do think we're getting better at trying to understand the actual pathophysiology for if there is a difference between an antagonist and an agonist. And, you know, I personally believe that there is, which is why I think relugolix has been a real advance for the field, not only because of the sudden decrease, because it's an antagonist in the T, the rebound when you stop it is very quick, but very, very specifically, this potential cardiovascular lessening of risk. There's been some data work that's coming out. I know there's the OPTICS trial being led by Dan Spratt, and I think it's real world data. I look forward to the final presentations there, because I don't think compliance is going to be an issue. It's, you know, one pill once a day. Some people have talked about that, but I don't really think that'll be problematic. There are larger trials, I think we'll be looking at safety and tolerability profile as well. Well, there have been some nice studies combining, you know, relugolix with all four of the androgen receptor blockers, from abiraterone to apalutamide to darolutamide to enzalutamide. So the DDI shouldn't be a concern. But I think, like with anything, if patients are on polypharmacy, one needs to be cognizant of it. But that's not been an issue. At least in the U.S. now, from an economic standpoint, there was some concern. But one of the nice things about the bipartisan support for the Inflation Reduction Act a few years ago has really lowered the out-of-pocket cost for all oral oncolytic therapies, including other high-cost oral agents and parenteral agents. So I think that shouldn't be a concern for most patients, fortunately. So I think the Inflation Reduction Act was really good for our oncology patients, as well as non-oncology patients too. You know, being an oral, not having a generic, it will be a little bit more costly than the parenterals. But for the reasons that I stated, I think it's certainly something that you'd want to have a shared decision-making conversation with patients and their families.
Anything else that you wanted to say about how, in your practice, you have seen ADT use affect patient quality of life and any other sort of interventions that might be done here?
Yeah, I mean, we just published, the final results of the EMBARK trial. This was patients with high-risk biochemical recurrence, rapid doubling times, PSA doubling times after, you know, recurring disease after prostatectomy or radiation or both. And, you know, there's now an opportunity with the approval of enzalutamide. Not everybody needs to have testosterone suppression. And I think that testosterone suppression, albeit the mainstay, the bedrock, the foundation of our prostate cancer care, particularly in metastatic patients and arguably in high-risk localized patients who are receiving radiation, and even, you know, high-risk BCR patients, there's a lot of really interesting, provocative trial work that's going on to see, can we avoid testosterone suppression? But I think that's another reason why, if I'm going to invoke testosterone suppression, I find there's a really very nice flexibility in using a once daily pill such as relugolix.
What is really the importance of collaborating with other, you know, members of the multidisciplinary team, like the pharmacy team or just anybody else when sort of using ADT in the clinic?
Yeah, that's a really important question, because the multidisciplinary team is really part and parcel now with really optimizing care. I've always felt that way. And the multidisciplinary paradigm is really one of the best things about our academic medical center models, And I think that that is becoming more and more inculcated into the community. You know, the burgeoning approvals in GU-oncology for both prostate, bladder, and kidney cancer, which is, you know, I'm a GU uro-oncologist, but it really does take multidisciplinary coordination with medical oncology, radiation oncology, nuclear medicine, radiology, a pharmacist, genetic interpretations. So, you know, I think that you could never strive hard enough to do that. Now, everybody can't do it as well as they might be able to if you have just one big center with lots of resources and funding. But I think given the complexity of care, because of all the great studies and trial work that's happening, you know, in biomarkers and imaging and therapeutics, the multidisciplinary team is the high bar that everybody needs to be striving for.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.